Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic. If you're looking for a snack that packs a punch, look no further than Avionola, a granola that can be taken on the go, and it's so versatile that it can be eaten as a snack or as a meal.
We love Avionola because of its nutritional content. Lots of granolas have a high sugar content, but not Avionola. This granola is sweetened with monk fruit, so it actually doesn't spike your blood sugar, and it's a great option for those who may be diabetic or looking for a low sugar alternative compared to other granolas. I mean, what could be better than a granola that only has 1 gram of sugar?
Not to mention it's keto approved, so that means it's only got 1 gram of carbohydrates, and this is because it's made with lupini beans. And y'all, I have to tell you right now, I would have no idea this wasn't made from a grain because it tastes so good. So go grab yourself a bag of Avionola at avi-foods.com and upgrade your granola fix right now. Use our code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your first order. Hey y'all, welcome back to this week's episode of the Pilots Pandemic podcast. You're here with your host Emma and our beautiful co-host Maddie.
Hey guys.
And this week we are joined by guest Brian Baumhoff. Thank you, Brian, so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, we're happy to have you, Brian, and excited to kind of dive in to your story and what you have to speak on today. But first, we like to start with how you became passionate about aviation. Like, where did your journey start for you?
Yeah, so I guess you could say that I came from an aviation family. It's interesting. My grandfather started a company that actually made aircraft interior parts. So mostly for Cessna, Beechcraft, Raytheon, eventually much larger planes like Boeing 747s. And so we have a family business that has been involved on the manufacturing side of aviation. We've had that more or less since 1952. And my father took that over in the 90s, and we just relaunched that a couple of years ago in 2021. And that's why I'm here today in Las Vegas at NBAA, National Business Aircraft Association, which looks like a fun conference. But other than the family business stuff, I can't really explain where it came from. I just always had an interest in flying, and I always knew that I had an interest. Like, ever since I was a kid growing up, I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And I ended up taking flight lessons in high school. So it wasn't a very structured program. It was basically just me on the weekends when I wasn't doing homework, going out to the airport, doing flight lessons. I was living in Tucson, Arizona at the time, which was super convenient because it was like always sunny, except the summer where you had to fly at like 5, 6 a.m. so that you didn't evaporate. But yeah, I've always been interested. And then also on my mom's side of the family, my grandmother is a flight instructor, and she did that for like 30 years in Kansas. I'm from Kansas originally.
Wow, that's actually really amazing. I had no idea that your grandma was a CFI. I'm sure she has plenty of stories to tell. Are you the first pilot in your immediate family?
I am. Yeah, I am. My grandmother actually had, it's a Piper Warrior. So I think it's maybe like 10 years after your model, because isn't yours in like a 1960 something?
Maddie? Yeah, mine's a 1967 Piper Cherokee, but
Cherokee. You know, okay.
I love anything Piper. I'm like, hell yeah.
Yeah, they're fun.
That is so unique to have have somebody in your family that's a female in aviation. I feel like it's really incredible because it's still something that's so like, we're such a small percentage of it. But for your grandma to be in aviation, that's super unique. and has to, that definitely is where that love has to come from. They say you love things that your grandparents did, your parents did, and that it's in your DNA. And I swear that's where it all comes from. But yeah, that is so cool.
Yeah. And she just retired recently. Basically, she was sort of at the point where she thought she couldn't do it safely anymore, which was wise of her to make that decision. But yeah, she did it all her life, and like many, many years, many different people over the years. So it was a joy to fly with her. Well, the flying in Kansas is weird for me because I'm from Kansas, but I grew up in the West Coast, and it was like no landmarks anywhere. And so I would get lost because it was just kind of flat. So I like my mountains and my,
I can't even imagine. Yeah, it's just like straight. Is it like very rolling plains, just flat for days, is what I'm envisioning, like Wizard of Oz?
Yes. Yeah, it is very flat. Very, very flat. The horizon just goes on forever.
Wow. I feel like every state is very unique in its own way, but that's interesting. Thank you for elaborating. But I want to ask you my next question. And one of the reasons that we connected with you was something that we all kind of have a passion for, which is aeromedical advocacy. So what specific challenges have you encountered with the FAA's aeromedical system, and how have these archaic practices affected your career or fellow pilots that you know?
Yeah, so they've definitely affected my career and fellow pilots. So it started, let's see, I got my license. So when I was in high school, I started having mild depression, anxiety symptoms. It kind of turned into moderate depression, anxiety symptoms. And I decided to address those freshman year of high school without really thinking much about the consequences. I wasn't thinking about that at the time. And it was remarkably successful. I mean, I started therapy and I started medication, and I was almost a new person, like within a year. It really helped me. And so the last 3 years, I actually learned how to fly on Prozac while I was taking the SSRI, and I had to go off of Prozac. This was back in 2006, which is a long time ago now. And I had to go off of it in order to solo and actually get my license, which, because the special issuance process back then was a little bit different. This was before the SSRI path. So I went off the medications, got my license, and then within about 6-9 months, I would say, my symptoms slowly started coming back. And so I came to the realization, okay, maybe this is something that I can hang this hobby up for a while and I'll get back into it later, but I need to take care of my mental health right now. And so I did that. And then 2010 came along and they had the SSRI protocol, but it was kind of a nightmare getting all that paperwork together because some of it was my home doctor, some of it was in the college, like the college counseling center. They were all over the place. One of my psychiatrists, the original prescribing psychiatrists, who was who they wanted the paperwork from, retired, and I just couldn't get a hold of him. I couldn't find his assistant. I couldn't find anyone. And so I ended up, when I tried to go through it, I ended up getting denied for failure to provide information because I just wasn't able to get a hold of all that information quickly enough, which was my fault because I should have canceled it once I realized that I wasn't going to make the deadline, but I didn't realize that it was going to be such a big deal to reapply. So I've been thinking about reapplying, and over the past few years, because I do basically meet the protocols now, so I'm getting my records all together. And so I was learning about mental health space and how that's evolved, and it seems like it hasn't really evolved all that much in aviation since the last time I encountered the system about 10 years ago. And that's what led me to you guys. And I started listening to the podcast, and I started following a bunch of the people that you follow on social media that are advocates, mental health advocates, because I consider myself a very strong mental health advocate in general. And I thought that there was room for some more intense advocacy on this issue. And so I've reached out to you guys, and that's how we started talking about the little nonprofit that we got going.
Yes, which we are very excited about and we'll be diving more into. I actually just didn't realize how long ago that you had applied for your medical and the process of that. So I'm glad you expanded, because I'm sure things were a little bit different as you were explaining it in 10 years ago, but that it's not too much different from now, which is the issue that we constantly talk about with the FAA and their air medical system, is that they are so entrenched in archaic practices. So since you've kind of navigated the system and are still navigating it, could you share like a specific personal story or experience that kind of illustrates the difficulties you've faced with the FAA's air medical system?
Yeah, I would say the just the lack of knowing for sure, like sending in the paperwork and then just waiting and waiting and then getting more requests and not being able to talk to someone. I mean, just that's emotionally draining. And I know everyone who's gone through this process, and I'm just a recreational general aviation pilot. I mean, this isn't my career, although I should say, if the medical issue wasn't such a big deal, it might have been more of my career than it is now. That's one of those ifs that I'll never really know for sure. But I decided not to go off of medications for my career, which is the right choice for me, but I probably would have been doing something in aviation. I definitely would have been flying. I definitely would have been flying for the last 10 years. And I know friends and colleagues who run into this issue. One of my friends, a good friend of mine from high school, he was a flight instructor, and he had some anxiety issues that were pretty mild, but he thought that the process of going to the COG screen and all the paperwork, it was just too much, and he decided to not pursue a career in aviation. And so he works in another field now. And there's so many stories about that out there. And I mean, it's emotionally draining for those of us who have to go through it, and knowing that so many people don't have to go through it, even if they might also have issues that should qualify them to go through it. It's like you get punished for doing what they ask. It's not a great feeling.
No, it's definitely not. I really liked also that you pointed out how you did try to go off your medication. I think you're someone who's very in tune with your body, because the fact that you went and got mental health care at such a young age kind of points to being very intuitive of your health and your wellness. But I think this is also something that we haven't really talked about on the podcast, is you're on the medication, you want to fly, so you go off of it, but then you realize, well, this isn't working for me. Like, I needed that medication for a reason. And I think that is difficult for pilots to come to terms with, is the fact that you may never be able to go off your medication. Like, this is like something in your brain that you need help with. And so I'm glad that you pointed that out, because oftentimes I feel like people feel that they're weak for taking medication. And mm-hmm. I hate that people think that, and it's something that I just wish that we were more open about. So I'm glad that you shared that, because people need to hear that it's okay to still be on medication, because it is helping you.
Absolutely. And another thing that complicates my case, and I know this is true of a lot of people as well, is I've been on what's, I guess they call multi-drug protocol, which is the FAA doesn't like, but it's when the psychiatrist, they have a broad toolkit. And so if the SSRIs don't work for whatever reason, and about half the people, SSRIs don't work, or they're not optimal, or the side effects are too strong. And there are so many other options out there in psychiatry, several of which I've used that I considered more benign than the Prozac that I was on in terms of side effects. There's also like TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. That's a totally medication-free therapy that causes basically no side effects except a headache. It sounds gnarly, but it's pretty benign. And then there's like new research on mental health coming out every day, it seems like. And I am cautiously optimistic that we're finally getting to a point where we're going to start to figure out the human brain and psychology a bit better than we have in the past, because it's dated, and any psychiatrist would admit that they're really just guessing. I mean, these are groups of symptoms that they put into disorders within the DSM to sort of make it easier to categorize things, but if you say someone has depression, I mean, that could mean so many different things depending on the individual. And so that's why it's frustrating that the FAA says like it's a case by case basis, but we all know from dealing with them that it's really more like a checklist. They're trying to fit human psychology through a flowchart and a checklist, and it just won't work.
I'm glad you elaborated on that and explained further, because I've said that a lot on the show, that it feels very much like, even though they say that it is case by case, it is very much the opposite. People don't, I think there are people who get what I'm saying, and I think there's another half of people who don't really get it, but it's just like you said, a lot of things in mental health are on a spectrum. And also, like you pointed out, there are so many things in the quote unquote toolbox that we can use to treat these things. And the fact that we are limited to 4 medications is crazy when you start to really understand like the broadness of treating mental health. It just feels really silly and stupid. But I wanted to ask you, as both a pilot and a political organizer, how have you been able to leverage your experiences to advocate for change within the aviation industry?
Yeah, well, just first one quick comment on medications. So that with the 4, I mean, it would be totally justifiable if they had a mountain of evidence to prove that all the other medications and therapies were patently dangerous. They obviously don't have that. And so that's why this policy is just so many ways that it's problematic. But sorry, can you repeat that last question?
No, you're fine. And honestly, thank you for saying that, because you just further are proving that point. And I really appreciate that, because those are things that need to be said. And honestly, I'll probably now repeat them until I'm blue in the face. So thank you. But I just wanted to ask how you've been able to use both your experience as a pilot and a political organizer to leverage and advocate for change within the industry.
Yeah, so I skipped over that part. So instead of getting into aviation right after college, what I got into was political organizing. And I started working for a few campaigns. I've always been interested in politics. My undergrad is in political studies. And so I volunteered for campaigns, mostly at the state level. The first big campaign I worked for was Washington State's marriage equality campaign, which was super fun. I mean, that was, most campaigns are a drag, but that was a really fun campaign to work on. And then I was a fundraiser for a mayoral candidate. I was a fundraiser for one of Washington's senators, and then a few statewide ballot initiatives, a gubernatorial candidate in a different state. And I've done a little bit of work on the federal level, but mostly state. And so I'm basically a political organizer / fundraiser until we got back into the family business a couple of years ago, because I felt like around 2018, things got a little weird politically. And I was like, it's time to take a step back from politics and maybe try to get back into aviation. But yeah, so in terms of the intersection of my political experience and my aviation experience, I didn't think that they would meet up in the way that they have. But when I was going through the podcast and then sort of trying to read all the resources out there on the web, it seems like there's there are people like Dr. Billy Hoffman who have done some great research. There are other people at the undergrad level who are doing great research. There's a lot of people who are really passionate, who care about this issue, but it seems like there hasn't been a unified political response that's sort of all in one. It seems like a lot of us are sort of in different camps. And I think you guys are probably the most active and the most helpful and the most inspiring, frankly. But I was like, I wonder if there was a way to start an organization that's a little more formal and a little more targeted specifically at members of Congress, not just the FAA, because we already have organizations like NBAA, AOPA, EAA, all the other FAA adjacent nonprofit industrial complex organizations. And they all have their own niche. They all serve their own audience. But there's no political nonprofit organization that is specifically aimed at the issue of pilot mental health, specifically improving policies or altering policies. And I was like, we should make that. And so I reached out to you guys and got the paperwork rolling for that this summer. And we've been, I don't know, we can talk a little bit about the progress we've made. But yeah, we're about to launch. It's exciting.
It's just so exciting. So just a little background for our audience. Like, Brian reached out to me, I think it was like on Instagram, and you started talking about like wanting to advocate politically and told me kind of like your background. I was like, yes, like lead the way, Brian. And I didn't realize how serious you were, but because Emma and I honestly run into a lot of people who want to advocate, but then they don't follow through. So when you started making things happen, I was like, wow, I'm like very impressed and very excited to do this with you. So both Emma and I are part of the Pilot Mental Health Campaign organization that Brian is the founder of. And it's very exciting. Like, we're obviously in the very beginning stages of things, building the foundation. But I can't wait to see where we go with it, because now we're able to kind of push funds towards Congress, and you know, money makes people listen, so that's the big thing.
It feels very surreal as well. I just have to say thank you, Brian. I texted Maddie the other day and I was like, it's just crazy, because for the past almost 3 years, it feels like Maddie and I have been working really hard at this, and so for something to really come from it and for us to be able to connect with you. And it feels like when you were explaining your story and how you went through this process, you've been down the pathway with the FWA, you've seen like the insides of what it all entails. You come from, you know, an aviation family, but then also having that political experience. It's like, you're literally an aeromedical angel. So I'm so very thankful and ecstatic, like over the moon. It's pretty much all you'll find me talking about with my family and friends these past couple of weeks. It just feels insane. And I cannot thank you enough.
Oh no, I feel the same about you guys. Cause I thought about doing something like this, like, years ago, but when I would ask like friends and stuff, it seemed like everyone was a little cautious. Like I was at Oshkosh, and I think this was like 2011. And I went to their little mental health forum because they just launched the SSRI protocol. And there was this one guy who like stood up and asked a question. And he was like, I have a friend who is on Zoloft. What do you think my friend should do? And the people on stage were like, well, here's the procedure. Just declare everything, be honest. Sort of boilerplate standard answer. And then if you look at the forums like last year, you actually have people being much more blunt. Like I was there in 2022 and people were like, this is ridiculous. Why can't, like, this is so silly. And so there's been a cultural change, but it really took people like you to get people's stories out there, because people's stories are so incredibly powerful. And for policymakers, I can tell you that they do care about stories. And there's a lot of, I mean, if you look at Washington right now, Washington, D.C., it's kind of a mess. But there are a lot of good people there who are there for the right reasons, who would care about this issue if they knew much more about it. And so the affidavits that you have gathered through the petition and that you have submitted, those have gotten through. I mean, you've mentioned it on the podcast before, like the FAA, we know, has looked at them. The aviation subcommittee has looked at them. It needs to be accompanied. First of all, we need more of them. So if you're listening to this and you haven't reached out to your congressional representative, you should, because, I mean, it's one of the easiest ways to advocate for yourself, and it's free. And so you can just go online and, you know, find what district you're in, and then phone call is probably best because it's more personal. You know, just tell them who you are, tell them where your district is, tell them specificity is good. So like give them a bill if they're working on it. If you don't know the bill number, just be as specific as possible and just be kind and polite and to the point, but feel free to add your personal story. And then if not phone call, then email works, or a personal letter. Form letters are probably prioritized lowest. But those personal communications, people do actually read those, because I used to be a congressional intern and I can tell you people actually, we do actually read them. And so I do encourage everyone listening to contact their congressional representatives.
Brian, I had a question too, like sending like the affidavits. Can you kind of express why collecting a large sum of affidavits is important for sending to Congress?
Yes. Yeah. So volume, they care about quality, but they also care about volume and intensity. So if they get a bunch in a relatively short period of time, that catches their attention more than if they're spread out. And if they get a large volume, that will get more attention than if they're smaller. But the problem for us is, and I know you've encountered this, is that first of all, our constituency, I guess you would say, is very hesitant about coming forward, about being open and honest about these things and communicating. They don't even, many of them don't want to use their real names, and for good reason. I mean, I totally empathize with why they're afraid. But you have to come forward, and that's how change happens, is that the policymakers will see that we're real, we're people, we pose no threat to safety, unless there's, you know, a mountain of evidence that suggests otherwise. But lacking that mountain of evidence, I think it's fair to say we pose little threat to safety. We can, if you wanted to get into the weeds and the nuances, I mean, there are certainly people who should not be flying. I'm not advocating for just everyone to fly without a medical. That's not what I'm a fan of. But yeah, what was the rest of your question?
Oh, I think that was it. I think you covered it great. I just wanted our audience to understand, like, those affidavits in large numbers make a huge difference, and we need as many as can be provided to us. So I'm glad you expanded on that. But
yeah, and that was it.
Go ahead.
So the other thing, and the reason that we started PMHC, that's the name of the organization, Pilot Mental Health Campaign, PMHC.org. And it's a 501c4 organization. So it's different than a 501c3, which would be your more standard charity. A C4 is more aimed at political activities. It gives us more leeway to lobby Congress directly. So the problem with our group is there's a lot of people who don't want to come forward, and then the just underlying number of us is not very large. And that is why, when you have that kind of situations, what you need to do is consolidate political power by coming together and organizing into a very tight-knit group that has a coherent strategy. And then another very important part of that is money, because with money you can do things like donate directly to members of Congress. There is that, but money also pays for communications. Money pays for research, money pays for outreach, money pays for, you know, running the website, hosting conferences, direct mail, phone calls, email campaigns. Campaigns are very, very expensive. Organizing is very, very expensive. There's a reason that it's not that easy for people to do. And so that's where an organization like PMHC, 501c4, would come in, that sort of pools information and resources and directs them to their most efficient ways to get at policymakers to make change.
Thank you for expanding on Pilot Mental Health Campaign, because I think you packaged that really well for the audience. So what kind of reforms or improvements do you believe are necessary within the FAA's air medical system, and how have you been involved in advocating for these changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I did get to meet with our senator, Senator Maria Cantwell in Washington. I used to work for her campaign staff, so it was relatively easy for me to set up a meeting. That's why I just got lucky there. It's usually hard to meet with senators and Congress people, but you can if their schedule is open and you're open. I suggest requesting a meeting too whenever you reach out to them. And if not them, then a member of their staff. And I expressed basically, I told her my story. I told her the issues that we had faced. I told her all the pilot friends that I knew about who knew that this was an issue. And she asked a lot of questions. She was very concerned. And I think that's pretty standard for most members of Congress. I think they don't know a lot about this issue. They're used to delegating nearly all of this to the FAA ever, because I mean, it's complicated, right? Aviation's very complicated. So, and congressional staffers aren't usually equipped to understand all of these nuances. And so speaking directly to a member of Congress like that was, I think, a great way to communicate the message. And then I've also written my member of Congress, Derek Kilmer in the 6th District. And I've reached out to several other organizations, and then people like you. And then I started PMHC, which is about to hopefully do a lot more organizing on that front. And in terms of the specific policies, this is where it gets a little complicated, because I have my personal opinions, and then Pilot Mental Health Campaign is probably going to come to our own conclusions. And by the way, on the website, you can submit an information form, a contact form. Tell us what you think the ideal solution in your mind would be. I would really like to know that. And we, in the coming weeks and months, we'll probably be sending out surveys and things like that, so that we can try to gauge where the majority of the pilot community is and where they want to see changes. But I think some things that need to happen, I mean, it cannot take 2 years for an SSRI. That is just insane. Dosage changes on SSRIs are not a big deal. Yes, you'll have some side effects initially. You'll know mostly what those side effects are within the first few weeks, and then they usually get better after the first few weeks. Most of the side effects are not cognitively impairing. And so, and that's true with a lot of other medications other than SSRIs too. Some cause sedation more so, which is something to look out for. But it's an individual basis. Like I said, I mean, some people will freak out on an SSRI. Some people, it's like candy, like nothing happens. And that's true of most medications. So it needs to be a tailored case-by-case basis. And I think the individual's treating physician should have much, much more leeway, much more influence over the decision-making process, because they know the pilot much better. And I understand why the FAA would be hesitant to trust some physicians, because as we've heard, they're concerned about doctors advocating for their patients too much. But that really is their job, because unless they hate their patient, they're going to try to find a way to make it work, as long as they're not lying. That's important. So I think more influence at the local level, more influence for the person's treating physician, and dramatic improvements in technology. And then I also want to see a focus on research, because we need to prove that what we've been doing for the last 20, 30, 40 years is actually based in science. And you can say things like, well, these medications cause fatigue in some people, these disorders cause fatigue or maybe suicidal tendencies for a very rare number of people. And you can make that generalization, but do they really have data trying to figure out who those people are, what those populations look like, who is most at risk? Do they actually have that data, or is it sort of just a stigma-based policy rather than an evidence-based policy? And so we need to move it to a much more broad evidence-based policy.
Amen.
I can't agree more. Could you discuss like the importance of raising awareness about these issues, not just like pilot to pilot, but with the broader public and with policymakers?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we'll be working on with PMHC, because I mean, I've spoken to a fair number of psychiatrists and psychologists over the years. And most of them have no idea that this is a thing, that this is a policy in the 21st century. I spoke to a psychiatrist at an event the other day. I was telling him about the current process, and he just started laughing out loud and like shaking his head. He was like, oh, the FAA, those people. And this guy was like a Harvard credentialed, brilliant, brilliant psychiatrist, actually. That's so common for people in the medical field to feel like this is totally backwards. And so I think we need to reach out to more people in the medical field, like the American Medical Association. There are tons of different doctors' associations. I want all the doctors to know what this is like for pilots and how they can help pilots navigate the system.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think like you nailed it on the head with like, you're talking about talking to people in Congress, not really knowing about the issue, and just like the general public too. I mean, we need to talk to our friends about these things so that people actually have a real picture of what pilots are dealing with, because I think it's easy for the FAA to really sweep it under the rug because not a lot of people understand what it takes to hold the medical and to continue working as a pilot. So thank you for touching on that. But sorry to cut you off.
Oh, no, not at all. And then I would say, and hopefully we'll have some resources up on PMHC to help people do this, but journalists are bored most of the time. So you should write a letter to the editor, to your local newspaper. I mean, they will actually read them. It may or may not get submitted, but they will read them. And I mean, there it seems like there's increasing interest across the media spectrum on this issue right now. And so I think now is a good time to take advantage of that. And so if you have a story to tell, you should, you know, write a little op-ed, reach out to a local journalist, let them know, tell them how you feel.
I like that advice. I actually haven't thought about like reaching out locally, but I'm like, I should do that. This is a big aviation community in the Pacific Northwest, so I'm sure someone would pick it up. I just haven't thought about it. But moving on with my last question, what advice would you give to other pilots who may be facing similar challenges with the FAA's aeromedical system and they want to make a difference through advocacy?
Yeah, so if you're currently facing challenges, definitely don't do what I did and sort of just dove right in. I was very naive. I didn't understand that. It never occurred to me that there would be such consequences for what I considered to be a relatively mild case of depression and medication use. And so definitely do your research. Definitely make sure that all of your paperwork is very well sorted before you apply. I'll hedge towards not trying to provide medical advice. I don't want to get myself in trouble there because everyone's a little bit different. Certainly, if you need help, do not avoid getting it because of this. Definitely seek help. In terms of advocating, you should sign up on pmhc.org. That's pmhc.org. You can go there right now. You can sign up. You can make an account if you'd like, and you can make a donation. And I think as of right now, for on our end, I think that's probably our biggest ask at the moment. You know, write those letters to the editor, send us your stories. We need more stories. We love hearing stories. Send us more stories. We can, by the way, we can protect people's identities to journalistic standards if they're not comfortable being open. Or you can talk to a journalist directly and make sure that they protect your identity. They're capable of doing that. They have procedures for doing that. So if you want to be anonymous, that's totally fine. But if you're open to being more open, get involved. Let us know that you want to get involved and we'll get you involved. And make a donation and tell all of your family and friends to make a donation. Because it, as part of my career as a fundraiser, it's always been weird for me asking for money because I hate it. I'm not a salesperson. I don't like asking for money. But as working on the receiving end of that, it's so easy for me to see how that translates into afford this mailer. If we make this amount of money, we can afford this research piece. If we make this amount of money, so much of this is dependent on money. And I wish that weren't the case, but it is. And so if you would like to make a donation, there's a donation button right there at the top. None of us are on salary. We're all volunteers. None of this money will go to any of us personally. It's all going towards advocacy efforts. And they have to, because it would be illegal for them not to. So they'll all go towards advocating specifically for making changes to FAA medical policy. No other issues, no lead fuel, no closing airports, no other issues that are, you know, important issues that people care about. But this is just our issue that we care about. And if you make a donation, it'll help a lot.
Yeah, and I wanted to also let our audience know, like, we have had people who are listeners, they've donated it to the change.org petition that Emma's made, but I want all of you to know that that money also doesn't go towards us, and I think that that money goes towards the petition getting more signs, but the money that you donate to the pilot mental health campaign will, like Brian said, go directly to us advocating for changes at the aeromedical field. So it's much more focused on what we want to change, whereas the change.org was just getting those petition signatures, which are very important because they endorse our message for change. But if you are thinking about like donating on change, we'd really like to guide you guys to the pilot mental health campaign, because those resources will be directly used for aeromedical change.
Yeah, the organization is set up. It's designed to take funds for this purpose and spend funds for this purpose, as opposed to the change.org, which is more advocacy related, but related towards getting more of those signatures in the door, which is also important.
Yeah. So my last and final question for you, Brian, and to wrap up kind of the end of the show before our fun questions, is what are your hopes for the future of the aviation industry, especially regarding the aeromedical system? And well, you just kind of covered how our listeners can get involved in supporting this cause, but I guess so I'll just stick with that first one. What are your hopes?
I'm optimistic, and in terms of aviation, like I just came from, I set up our booth at NBAA, and I was just on the convention floor, and there's a palpable energy, and there's a lot of new technologies. There's so many young people here. They have a career fest going on right now. It's just such a dynamic industry. And of course, all the eVTOL, electric vertical takeoff and landing, that's an acronym. They have all like the eVTOLs are all here. The new technology aviation, I'm super excited about, and old technology too. I mean, there's still a lot of room for improvement in technologies. I'd love to see more young people get involved in aviation. I think the aeromedical process is one of those key issues that has to be solved before that happens, because I mean, Generation Z, my generation, millennials, we don't view mental health the way that our parents did, or our parents' parents did, certainly. Like, it's like when I chose to get help in high school, not a big deal. Like, it was not a big deal to me. And I think that getting a policy framework in place that recognizes that for most people, this is not a big deal. For a small number of people, yes, they do need to be in more intensive treatment and possibly not be flying some of the time. But I think that there are just thousands and thousands of people who could be active in our industry, contributing to our industry, adding economically to our industry. I mean, there's a study that would be interesting, like how many people have been kept out through the aeromedical system, and how many billions of dollars would that have added to the American economy for no loss in aviation safety. I'd like to see them run that study.
Yeah.
So I'm optimistic. And on the aeromedical front, big organizations don't like change. It's not just the FAA. It's most governments. These sorts of changes, especially if the policy has been around since like the 60s, 70s, 80s, these are really hard to change. There's a lot of bureaucratic inertia. But I think the time is right, and we'll just have to punch through. And I should say, if anyone from the FAA happens to be listening, I want to be explicitly clear. I respect your work as a public servant. For a while, I I worked in the Department of Parks and Rec for 6 months. So I was a bureaucrat for a little while. It is tough because there are lots of things that you want to do in your little cubicle, but you're restrained from doing because of the policies and procedures that have been put in place for good reasons, but they're just too burdensome and it's too hard to change. And so if you're a member of the FAA who would like to help us move towards a brighter future for pilots, let me know. We'd love to work with you. But if the answer is going to be sort of just an obstinate digging in of the heels and denying that there's any problem, then maybe we won't work quite as well.
I'm glad you said that because I think it's important to remember that, yes, it may feel like we are against the FAA, but really we have to work together to solve this issue. I feel like oftentimes we're seen as defensive or combative over these issues, but really genuinely it all comes from a place of true caring for an industry that desperately needs the attention. And going back to your point about what you said initially about how there is probably a large amount of young people right now who cannot get into aviation solely based off of the medical policies alone. And I think that's really, really important to point out, because I don't think a lot of people are thinking about it. And we are in the midst of a pilot shortage. And I constantly think about that every single day. You know, how many people are not going out and seeking being a pilot because they know, or they went to do it, and when they applied for their medical, they were denied over something that they did in middle school or high school, or maybe it's ADHD. It's kind of sad to think about, because we should never stigmatize getting help for yourself. And I think that was another message that I love that you shared, Brian, is that, you know, you got the help that you needed and you are way better off for it, regardless of aviation, you know? And I think that's a message that we also should hone in on, is that you have to choose for yourself, even though it may seem like aviation is going to be the one thing that'll make you the happiest. Sometimes you have to make yourself happy, and it's really only you in this world, and to take care of yourself, nurture yourself, love yourself, and get yourself the help that you need. And you should never be punished for it.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. And if you are, I imagine there are some people listening to this podcast who might be struggling. It does get better. I mean, depression is such a insidious, nefarious disease, but it does get better with treatment. And if your initial treatments don't work, there's a lot of other things that they can do. So please keep trying. It sucks, but stick with it. And I made a quick note about in terms of like the population, the young population. The FAA is not trying to discriminate, but they basically are, because certain members of our population are disproportionately affected by mental health issues, like the LGBTQ population. I forget the exact statistic, but it's quite a bit higher. Women are about twice as likely to have some sort of mental health issue at some point in their lives. Veterans are much more likely to struggle with these issues. There are all sorts of different populations that this policy would have a disparate impact on, not because they want it to, but the effect does matter.
Definitely. I definitely mentioned that, and I have feel the same way. And minorities are also affected by this as well. And that's important to remember, is that the FAA isn't actively seeking to discriminate, but with the policies that they have in place, they are discriminating against these groups of people. So that's another reason we are fighting for change, because the policies they have in place are discriminatory. So thank you so much, Brian, for speaking with us today. I'm really excited for the Pilot Mental Health Campaign and working with you, and all the knowledge that you have, and just the passion that you have too. It means a lot, and I'm very excited for the future and to see what we can all do together.
I am very, very excited too. And I'm so glad that I came across this podcast and met all y'all, because it's a great group of people. And So yeah, visit pmhc.org. You can reach out. I'm Brian at pmhc.org or info at pmhc.org. Let us know how you'd like to help, what you'd like to do, if you'd like to host an event. We'll try to make it work, whatever you want to do. And also let us know if you'd like to come to DC for a lobbying trip at some point in the next year.
I know, I'm very excited for that too. But you heard Brian, go to all those handles, go follow us, go donate to the Pilot Mental Health Campaign, because those funds are going to help us make change. And now we're going to move into fun questions. Since Brian and I are both living in the Pacific Northwest, these are all kind of like Pacific Northwest themed, and Emma's been to Washington, so she can join in on this too. So the first one that I have for you is, what's your go-to rainy day activity or place to visit when the weather isn't cooperating?
I feel like in the Pacific Northwest, you have to just do whatever you're going to do, regardless of whether it's going to rain, because it's just going to rain during the winter. But I guess I don't know that I have a go-to rainy day spot. Probably just like at home, curled up by the fire with a good book.
I love that you said that, because and in the beginning how you said like, if it's raining here, like you're just gonna go out, because it's so true. Like I remember, I think this was like a year ago, there's a brewery right across the street from me, and the wind is whipping the rain like sideways, but the brewery, I go, well, I'm like, let's just do it. Let's just bundle up and go. Like, it's not a big deal. They have the little heat warmers. And so Jesse and I go, and the place is packed. So rain really doesn't like deter anyone here. But my favorite rainy day activity is actually like to kind of like either go to a pub or like a nice fancy dinner where it's like warm. If I want to do something other than staying at home on the couch, that's what I would do.
Or like a coffee shop or something.
Yeah, coffee shop, it works great too. I love like those cozy environments. But Emma, mm-hmm. I know it doesn't rain there a lot, but like, what are you gonna do if it is raining?
When it does rain, I also agree with you, Maddie. Like, I love to, well, okay, the one thing I always find myself doing when it rains is like shopping. Like, I don't know why, but I always end up like shopping, whether it's like a Target run or going actually grocery shopping or just randomly like going to the vitamin shop, just random things like that. End up doing that. I love to go get like some sort of late lunch, early dinner on a rainy day, somewhere like a pub type atmosphere is perfect. I want it to be like a literal dungeon. I want it to be dark. I want it to feel like it's been lit by candles. I really lean in when it rains. And then I'm going to come home, and if it were up to me, I'd watch the entire Twilight series front to back.
That's a good one.
And I'd be living, pretending like I'm living where y'all live in the Pacific Northwest. Because ultimately, like when it rains here, I literally, it's like a mood switch. I'm like, okay, we're on our P and dub shit. Sorry, excuse my French. But it really is. I'm like, I'm literally just a little P and dub girl with my little rain boots on. Like, I'm so interesting, mysterious, when in all actuality, like it's humid. My makeup's falling off of my face. My hair looks terrible. I'm sweating through my raincoat because it only rains here in the summer. So it's really not a romantic vibe when it rains in the South.
It's also like pouring down rain when it rains. It's not like misty or anything like that.
Exactly. You nailed it on the head. I forget about that part. It's like severe thunderstorm weather and like tornado warning weather.
Yeah, and like after living in Tucson, because we have monsoons in the summer, like in Seattle, you know, you can go anywhere in the rain and you're not going to risk like your car floating away in a flash flood. Like, it's not real rain.
Exactly. No, I was thinking, it was funny y'all were talking about it. All I could think is like downtown Charleston floods so bad after just 2 inches of rain, and then we get like king tides and all these weird different tide stuff. So like, you have to actually plan around like, oh, I can't go to that part of downtown because it's flooded today. I even like 2 weeks ago, I tried to pull up to my gym and I had to go in from, there was only one road that could let me access where I needed to park from the gym because all the other roads were literally 2 feet of water and it rained 3 days ago. I was, what is this? So
it's like an event.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So next question, Brian, is if someone were visiting the Pacific Northwest for the first time, what's the one place or experience you'd recommend that they absolutely cannot miss?
Well, all the touristy stuff. I don't know that I have one. Let's see. I like the underground, the Seattle underground, because I'm sort of an infrastructure nerd. So I find that pretty cool. The city of Seattle burned down in the late
1800s. You got to talk about what the underground is, though, because I don't think I've ever shared what it is with Emma, and I've actually never gone.
It's interesting. I mean, there's not a whole lot going on down there. So the city of Seattle caught on fire in the late 1800s, I think. And so instead of like cleaning all the debris up, they sort of just pushed it all down towards the water. And so they covered up like the basement level of those, the like masonry brick structures. And so the second floor of all those buildings in Pioneer Square used to be the first floor. Or sorry, the second floor is now the first floor, basically. And so you go down one more and it's like this, all these buildings, you have like old lobbies from like the early, like really old lobbies and like hallways, and but it's right under the sidewalk. And they have skylights. And so you can take these tours, and they have haunted tours. And then they have tours with comedians, which I accidentally went on once. But that's a cool one.
That's so neat. Oh my gosh. I would love that. That sounds like fascinating. That kind of reminds me of, in Raleigh, North Carolina, I think like, I'm pretty sure it's not like just a legend. It's a legitimate thing, but there's a part of Raleigh that it's like basements like that. Something happened where they ended up just completely starting from ground zero again on top of it. And you can go, you can go underneath and it's like old theaters, old like kind of like speakeasy style things, but everything's like frozen in time. But unfortunately, I don't think the city of Raleigh is using it as like a touristy thing. I think like urbex people go underneath there, but it would be so cool if they would actually do something to open up those areas. I feel like there's also parts of New York that are like that as well. But again, they don't do anything with it. It's like you have to kind of break the law to get in there. So to be able to experience that, and it's like actual, like you open to the public, that is so cool.
Yeah,
it's a cool one.
Sometime, but when you mentioned like the history of it, I was like, oh, my husband will love that. So it's marked on like a date day thing that I'll need to do. But
yeah. Don't take the ferries, because some of us use those for transportation and we get annoyed when they're overcrowded with tourists. So just ferries are horrible. Stay away from ferries.
Why take a ferry when I can fly?
Exactly. That's I was true. Just about to say, Maddie's got all the means to get there. No ferries in that house. I literally right before I came to Washington saw a news article about a ferry somewhere in Washington that got stuck with a bunch of people on it. All their cars, like they were stuck on it all day. And I was like, you know what? I think I'll pass up on the ferry experience because that just unlocked a new fear for me. But I want to know,
they've been having some issues.
Which aren't they? I mean, they're kind of older boats, right? It's like,
they're not
brand spanking new. I could see, you know, some things happening. We have ferries all up and down. Well, not really up and down the East Coast. In North Carolina and specifically we have a lot of ferries, and it's like my worst fear, which somebody told me one time that no matter what happens, even if the thing sinks, you're in such shallow water in the East Coast that like the ferry will sit on the bottom and everyone can just stand on the top platform and be okay. Oh, so that kind of eases my mind a little bit, but I'm trying to think of like if I was visiting this specific, like the Pacific Northwest, from my opinion, as somebody who's not from there, I feel like I'm biased, but
you've done so much though. So I'm like, you've had a lot of experiences.
I know. Honestly, I loved Bellingham as a city so much. I don't know what it was about it, but like everything surrounding it, the national parks, all of it, the whole nine yards, the ocean, the water, the food, the this, the that. It's like, what can you choose? But I think the one thing that like I loved about my experience there was the food. Like, I feel like everywhere we went, the food was amazing. Eat your butt off. Nobody's talking about it enough. I feel like everyone talks about like eating in the South and like New York and all of that on the East Coast. Like, why are we not talking about the fact that everywhere that I ate in Washington was absolutely amazing? And also clap for the public transportation, clap for the accessible sidewalks, clap for the nature paths. Like I could just go on and on and on. I feel like I really can't recommend it enough. I got home and I'm like, everyone needs to go to Washington. Like, it is literally beautiful. It's the best place in America. So I really,
you did go during the summer though, right?
Yes. She came in August. Beginning of August?
July, like the end of July, beginning of August. So, I mean, it was freaking gorgeous. I was like, wow, this is just amazing. But honestly, another thing that I was thinking is like, just go drive around. I think that was so much of what we did, even though we flew and we saw the San Juan Islands, which go see the San Juan Islands, like didn't know those were a thing. Kicking myself for not realizing it. Like, go see the San Juan Islands, but drive. Like, go drive up in the national parks, go pick a place to drive, because I saw so much when we would just like get in the car for like 30 minutes and go somewhere. That was another big like favorite part for me. So I don't know, I can't say enough good things about where y'all live.
We really,
I think the San Juans are like my ideal retirement location. One day I would like a cabin on the San Juans.
Every time I fly to the San Juans, I'm like, I'm living here when I'm older. Like, I love island life. Like, I've always just loved like the slowness of island life, but the San Juan Islands is just, you get like the hiking and in the ocean and all of that, but then mixed with like the slow life, I have the same dream, Brian. I want to live there. And that is one of the things that I would say is, if you have to see one thing in the Pacific Northwest, it would be the San Juan Islands, because I don't think there's anywhere else in the United States that you find an island chain like the San Juans, with all the airports on the islands too. Like, that's also like unheard of. So that's my training grounds. I feel super spoiled that I get to fly there every day, and it's literally 15 minutes from my home airport, but hey, it is what it is. I'm just enjoying it.
Water is like gorgeous too. That was another thing. I was like, I don't know how Maddie like freaking focuses, because the ocean is like there's a word for it. Come on, Emma, use your words. It's like topography or
topography.
Yes, like basically I'm used to, you know, the ocean here. I mean, yes, they are blue, but it's just sand bottom. It progressively gets deeper and we have like the occasional trench, but the ocean water is so blue, and when you fly over it, you can see like rock structures underneath the water, like basically like little mountains underneath the water, and then you're surrounded by mountains that are above the water. It is unlike anything I've ever seen. Anyways, I there's another question about this. I could go on.
Yes. All right, last question. Brian, I'll have you start. What's your favorite outdoor activity or adventure in the PNW and why?
I've been wanting to do like skiing, snowboarding for years. I have skis, I can ski, but I've never like actually taken the time to get to the point where I'm not, you know, falling. But this year I got a season pass, and so that's my goal, because it's pretty in the winter too up in the mountains, and so I want to do some skiing. But if it's not snowing, then just hiking. I mean, there's a lot of great really hiking trails in the Washington area. Oh, and then one more cool thing, since I'm an infrastructure geek, there's like a bunch of old World War II forts, and they're in like national parks around the Puget Sound that were designed to like protect the Puget Sound from invading navies, and they're all decommissioned now, but they're these like huge concrete bunkers with like giant metal guns and very cool pieces of history. So some really cool national parks in Washington to check out. Oh, and since, in case anyone from Washington is listening, want to be nice to the east side of the state, it's also beautiful over there. Very different vibe. So if you have time, drive across the Cascades and you enter a desert. That's fascinating. It's really cool.
I'm from Eastern Washington, Brian. I don't know if you knew that, but I'm from Lake Chelan. So I grew up on the desert side, and I have happily implanted myself into the PN dub. I only go back home in the summertime because the lake's so beautiful there, but there's not a lot to do on the east side. But if you want like a really quiet, like remote time, go to the east side.
Mm-hmm.
But Emma?
Yes.
I'm trying to think.
What was your favorite activity? I feel like we did going a lot of crabbing.
We did a lot of walking, but I have to say it's the one thing I haven't talked about yet. Like, go see the baby seals. Like, the seals were so cool. I've never seen a seal in my life before. Like, even just like the way that the seaweed was growing in the ocean, I was like, what is this? Are we in Avatar right now? Like, it would, again, I'm like literally having childlike euphoria just thinking about it. Yeah, go get out on the water. Like, I feel like I see people all the time doing the whale watching and stuff. And like, I would have loved to see like a killer whale or something like that. But like, even without it, girl, just go get on the water, because it was gorgeous. Like, to see it from that perspective was just incredible. Obviously, I was
tell you. So I was on my way here to Vegas, and I was taking the ferry because I live in Kitsap County, and I was taking ferry over to Edmonds, and the ferry just stopped in the middle. And so either the ferry is broken, which seems to happen a lot, or there's like something in the way, and it was a pod of orcas. And so everyone ran out to the front and got out their phones, and it was like this beautiful little pod of orcas that was just moving through. And it was a nice send off.
I saw that on Facebook, because I think if I follow like the ferry system, I saw them post that. I was like, it's so cool when you actually get to see them in the wild. It doesn't honestly happen that often, but you're so lucky, Brian, you got to see them all on your ferry ride.
Yeah, it's not that common.
I'm like, oh my god, I could only imagine.
I'm like, I'll be in the plane taking off out of Bellingham Bay, and I'm like, where are those damn orcas at? I'm looking for them. But they never come around. I think out in the San Juans you'll probably see them a lot more, but I haven't seen them, and it's probably because they're too small to see at 3,000 feet, but you know what, a girl can wish. But for me, I also wanted to point out, when we went on that crabbing trip, Emma, we saw so many seals and a lot of baby seals, and that was freaking cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, baby seals. That was just, it was so cute. I'm like, oh, but it also really like, oof, I wish I would have had a wetsuit or something, because there was a massive part of me that just wanted to swim so bad. So bad. Because it's like rocky, and like, it's just a different, I don't know, the different terrain was very, again, just euphoric for me. I absolutely loved it. I had an amazing time. You can hear it through my voice. I'm like, I can't shut up.
Yes, I'm so glad that I gave you some cool memories.
Oh, but yeah, the best. But I like, what's your favorite? I need to know now.
Oh, I know it. This is so difficult. So many. Honestly, I feel spoiled again for saying this, but now that I have an airplane, literally what I'm going to do after this podcast is take that baby up and go over to the San Juan Islands. So that's probably like my favorite adventuring thing to do, and I love to do it with friends too. Like, Jesse and I are always like, what friend could we con into sitting into the back of Cherokee and so that we can fly him around? So if anyone volunteers to come fly with us, we will definitely take you up. But that is probably right now one of my favorite activities, but I also really do enjoy hiking. Jesse and I have loved hiking all the years that we've lived here. I used to hate hiking when I was little, and ever since I moved to Bellingham and I've lived here for 12 years, I have really enjoyed getting into hiking, because there's just, it's like a, you know, your backyard is, there's so much adventure to offer here. So I do feel spoiled in so many ways.
I know. I'm thinking about the naturopath and everything, and just even like walking around, like I said in the beginning, even just walking, like walking the town, walking the path that they give you from Fairhaven to Bellingham, like even just in that and walking around neighborhoods, I saw so many things that, like, for me as somebody who's lived on the East Coast my entire life, and I've been very blessed to like travel to Europe and things like that, there were things that I had never seen or experienced before. So I just feel like you're so blessed. Like, you could literally just walk around in your neighborhood and have a whole experience.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll also give a shout out to, because I learned to skydive in Snohomish. So yes, if you happen to be there in skydiving weather, you should, if that's your thing, that's really beautiful too up there in the summer.
That's at Skydive Snohomish. There's that Harvey Field, which is where my husband got his private pilot, I believe. Or no, he got his private at Regal, but he was a CFI at Harvey. And I was just there the other day.
Oh, nice. They have a nice restaurant.
Yes, we ate there. That's what we went for, is to go eat. But flying into that field, the airspace is quite difficult. I was... Yes. Jesse's like, okay, you're going to go here, and then you're going to go here, and then you're going to go here, because you don't want to hit Payne's airspace, and you don't hit this airspace. I'm like, oh God, and then you got to watch out for the skydivers, because you can't overfly the field. I was like, wow, there's a lot going on here. But
yeah. And the runway itself is kind of tricky. I'm super spoiled, because I learned on a 7,000 foot field. So every time I have like a smaller strip, field. I'm like, oh, that's so small.
I think that strip is 1,700 feet. Or I might be thinking of Camino. It might be like, but it's 2,000. I know it's like a little over 2,000 or a little under 2,000, but it's super short. I'm a
Jesus. Oh, I mean, I say that, but then again, it's like, that is very common practice where I'm from in North Carolina. There's like a ton of little airports like that, but it just still feels, hearing it is like, ooh, and it always looks so much smaller from above, like always looks so much smaller. Yeah. Gosh.
I'm with you on that though, Brian, is I've also like, I'm so spoiled in Bellingham with the long and wide runway that whenever I go to a short field, I'm like, oh my God, this does not look long enough.
Does Bellingham have two, or is it just the one main?
It's just the one main. I think that one time there was two, but that one, the second runway is just torn up, so I don't know if they have plans to redo it or not, but yeah, it's not there anymore.
Yeah, so you get like the giant runway to yourself.
Yeah, and I'm all about it.
I love that. Awesome. We used to have an airport close to us that was like, used to be, and I think it used to be a military base, but there's some weird reason, essentially. Oh, it's because it's close to Fayetteville's military base, which Fayetteville, North Carolina, and everyone knows it's like a huge, huge military base. But basically, they have an airport that's close by, and the airport and the runway is big enough to like facilitate if for some terrible reason, like they have to be able to land military planes and stuff there, it can facilitate that. And we used to go there a lot for our like short cross countries. And when you land on that runway, I want to say it's something insane. Like it's like 10, like it's something insane, like insane. The runway just goes on forever and ever and ever. And every single time you go there, you really feel like it sets in like how small you actually are in that Cessna 172, but it's super fun because you can fly over the runway for the longest time. Like me and my instructor were joking about it, and it was like, you could probably take off and land three times on that runway. It's that long. Yeah, it's pretty intense, but that always feels good. But you know what? We love the adrenaline of a short or soft field. Can't beat it.
I burn like 100 calories every time my heart starts rising whenever I'm on a short field. I'm like, oh my God.
I can't even, oh my gosh. It's taking me back to my flying days. I got to get up there again. But anyways, y'all, we are going to wrap up this week's episode. Brian, thank you so much for joining us again. And I can't emphasize how grateful I am to have met you and be a part of this campaign. It really does mean a lot to me that you want to do the damn thing and actually create some change. So I'm excited to see what we get after.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad I came across your path. And I'm so glad that you care so much about this issue, and you've sparked this little group of people that I think is going to become a big group of people. What's that quote? It's like, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful individuals can change the world. And indeed, it's the only thing that ever has, something like that. That's so true in politics. That's totally true. So yeah, anyone listening, definitely get involved, reach out, pmhc.org. Feel free to reach out to me directly via email, Ryan, Brian, at pmhc.org. Yeah, and thank you so much for the privilege of chatting.
Yeah, and we will be sure to link all of that in this week's episode description, as well as the post that we'll be making on Instagram. And there will be no shortage of, you know, us posting, reposting about this. And can't reiterate it enough, go and follow this page, because we need all the help and support that we can get. And yeah, donate. I don't even feel bad about it. Donate. Let us help you. So anyways, y'all, that is it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for tuning in and listening, and we will speak to y'all next week. Bye, y'all.